Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Black in Boston and Beyond, a podcast of the Trotter Institute. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on Black in Boston and Beyond, we have Professor Michael Nash, Professor of History at Essex County Community College, located in Newark, New Jersey. He is also the author of Islam Among Urban Blacks, Muslims in Newark, New Jersey, A Social History. Welcome to the show today, Professor Nash.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy day to talk to us about Black Muslims in Newark, New Jersey, but in urban centers more broadly, and particularly if we can make some connections to Boston, that would be great. The first part of our show, we are going to discuss Professor Nash's background, his research, and his teaching interests. Professor, tell us a little bit about your teaching and research.
Well, I've developed an appreciation for history, how it can be used as a tool to understand the present. And I always talk to my students about that, about how history can be used as a tool to understand some of the problems that exist in current times. So, more specifically, I've been very interested in African-American history and also the history of Islam among African-Americans. And that's been pretty much a broad subject that I've been studying since my undergraduate years, but more intensely as a graduate student. I really looked at that. And I would also add that New Jersey, the history of Islam among the Black people in New Jersey has been an interest of mine as well.
Yes, you were also a historian of New Jersey, African-Americans in New Jersey, and I think had done so much public intellectual work, not just in terms of your teaching, your writing, your scholarship. You're all three of those things at once, you know, public intellectual, professor, and activist. And so tell me a little bit more about how you started on this journey and decided to become a historian, because we do have a lot of students listening to our show, undergrads, graduates, and sometimes they're not sure what I want to major in. How do I figure this out? Did you always know you wanted to be a historian and study history, or was it more you encounter a great professor or a mentor that came into your life? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't start out really wanting to be a historian. I actually started out wanting to be an engineer. Interestingly.
Wow.
Yeah, one of my brothers, he was the first to go to college in the family. He was an engineer and he did very well in the field. He got his bachelor's degree from New Jersey Institute of Technology. And so my parents had hoped that I would follow in his footsteps because he had set such a good example. But I tried it. And it just didn't really appeal to me.
Mm.
And I think some Africana studies courses as an undergrad at Rutgers, that's when I really began to find my niche. And I decided then that I wanted to be a history major and also an Africana studies major. But I started out at New Brunswick. I was a undergrad at Rutgers in New Brunswick. And I did 3 years there and transferred in 1986 to the Rutgers North campus. And that's when I changed the major. I changed it. Let me back up a little bit, because I started out wanting to be an engineering major, but but I actually changed it to business. It might have been something like accounting or business management, something like that. So when I transferred to Rutgers Newark, I decided that I would change my major to Africana Studies, and eventually I added the history to that. And yeah. I was very, very happy when I did that.
Yeah, that's a very, it. You know, that's a common journey that we come into college. I think most college freshmen, they're not 100% sure what they want to study. They have an idea of what they like. And oftentimes, like myself, I went to Mattawan Regional, and they had, you know, majors within the high school that you could take specialized courses. And I was actually very interested in art at the time. So I was an art major. I had the other college prep classes that I took, but I entered college as an English major, and I eventually became a history major by my sophomore year. So it is a journey that we take, and it's okay when you arrive on the campus that you don't exactly have a major. It might take a year, you know, where you move through different classes. So for any of the grad students and undergrad students, particularly undergrad students listening to us today, know that it is a journey, and you don't necessarily have to have it all figured out before you arrive there. I knew I loved stories. I knew I loved the humanities. So I was just sort of moving around in those courses to see which ones that, you know, I really enjoyed the most. So tell us a little bit about your book and your other research work, because you've done so much, I think, just in your community, on your college campus, and also just in your writing, Islam Among Urban Blacks, Muslims in Newark, New Jersey, A Social History. Tell us a little bit about the history of Black Muslims in America and maybe the main premise of your work.
Well, Islam Among Urban Blacks was the subject of my MA thesis, and the focus was on the historical evolution of the African-American Muslim community in Newark, New Jersey, which is the city of my birth. I was born and raised in Newark. So looking back, I think there was a lot I tried to do in that book. Mm-hmm. Firstly, I wanted to tell the story of a community that impacted my own life in a positive way.
Sure.
Yeah. I had grown up as a Baptist. My parents, we went to Baptist church. But, you know, when I was in college, I underwent a conversion to Islam. And it was that community in the greater Newark area that kind of nurtured me and helped me along my spiritual journey.
Can you tell us a little bit about how? That's very interesting. I'm sure you had mentors in that community, and what attracted you, you know, to move from being a Baptist to gravitating to Islam. If you don't mind, you know, give us a little bit more detail about the process and the journey and the support you got from that community.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, like I used to attend the various Islamic centers in the greater Newark area. I think the first one that I attended was the one on, it used to be on Branford Place in Newark, and it was in the downtown area of Newark. And they had an imam, what we call in Islam, he was a very learned guy. He was from Ghana. He was the imam. He was the one that actually gave me the Shahada. Mm. And so I was helped along by some members. It was an African-American brother who I had met at Rutgers when I transferred. He was from Elizabeth, New Jersey. And he introduced me to some of the people in the Muslim Students Association at Rutgers, and a lot of them were foreign-born Muslims, but the guy that introduced me to them, he was an African-American like me. So you know, I got a pretty good, you know, in the beginning, I got exposed to a lot of different cultural influences of the Muslim world. Some of the Muslims in the Islamic Students Organization, some of them were from Egypt. I think some of them may have been had roots in Pakistan or India. You know, we were a really diverse group. And then it was me and this brother, we were born and raised here in America. So I spent a lot of time with him, my African-American friend, and I took some classes with the Ghanaian imam. I took, because he would offer introduction to Islam courses for new converts. So I remember taking a few classes with him. And through that, I met other African-Americans and, you know, met a lot of other people from the North area. And that's kind of how it started for me.
So can you tell us the difference between Black Muslims, the Black Muslim movement, the Nation of Islam, and just the idea of Black Muslims in America, right? People assume, okay, you know, they don't make the distinction between, right, more Science Temple origins, Nation of Islam in the 20th century. But one thing you point out in your book is that, you know, this has a longer history. So the difference between mm-hmm. somebody who's a Sunni Shiite versus somebody who's particularly associated with Nation of Islam, can you break a little bit of that down for us?
Yeah. Let me start by just giving a little historical narrative of the Nation of Islam, because that's the most well-known organization that operated within the African-American community.
Sure.
So the Nation of Islam is founded in 1930 by a foreigner named Farad Muhammad. Yet he had many aliases. He had other names that he went by as well. And he had been in the United States for a while, but he founded this organization in 1930. And he was from someplace in India, in that area of the world. And at some point, he connected with the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, which is also a group that's based in India. And we have a sister who did a dissertation on the subject of Farad Muhammad as well. Maybe I can talk a little bit what I've learned about that later. But they were active in the United States in the 1920s. Okay. So there is this strong connection between African Americans and Indian Muslims, because Farad Muhammad, he operated in the African American community in the Midwest, in Detroit. But also important to mention is the Morris Science Temple of America.
Yes.
Which was founded by an African American who was initially based in the South. Like many of our people, he migrated up north and settled. Interestingly enough, he settled in North for a while. And some say as early as, it must have been before 1913, because most historians cite 1913 as the year that he established his community. There was some organization that they called the Canaanite Temple.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So the founders of the Nation of Islam, I think, were also influenced by this organization as well. So they were influenced by, you know, Farad Muhammad, who came out of the Ahmadiyya community, and they were also influenced by the Moorish Americans, which were established in the 1920s, you know. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, by 1927, the Moorish American community, they have about, seem like I remember, you know, at least seven temples nationwide. So the Nation of Islam is not yet up and running until 1930 when Farad gets here. Now, you know, I wanted to lay all that out just to say that, so people from, say, the Arab world, maybe other immigrant Muslims from other parts of the Muslim world, they didn't have a very strong community life in the New Jersey area in the first quarter of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
What you see in the first quarter of the 20th century here in Jersey, in Newark in particular, is African Americans who are claiming Islam, you know, but it may not be the way that the Muslims in the East practice Islam.
Right. Yeah. So you're pointing out very multicultural origins of the Black Muslim movement in America leading to the rise of the Nation of Islam. And I think that's important. I think a lot of people are not aware of that history, that it's rooted in this sort of, I think, alliances really between Blacks, Black and Asian solidarity to an extent, which a lot of historians are writing about now. I can think of Keisha Blaine's work looking, you know, Black internationalism, the roots of Black internationalism, right? It's right here in, you know, more science and all of these other iterations of not just Black Americans, but Asian Americans, people from the Near East, forming or helping to lay the foundation, which is I think, a story that sometimes gets overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely internationalism going on between African Americans and Muslims from the Muslim world. You know, that connection is definitely there. It seems, though, you know, when I think about the things I've found through the research, it's important to think about the role that those people that call themselves Moorish Americans played. Because even when I'm talking about, particularly in this New Jersey area, you know, because unlike, say, places like Detroit or Chicago in the first quarter of the 20th century, here you had a lot of African Americans claiming Islam. But in Detroit, African Americans were there, but the immigrants were a lot more established in those places, like in those states.
So the founder of the Moorish Science Temple, he does move to the Midwest right after he first creates the first community in Newark, and then moves.
Yes, yeah, he does. He moves to I forget which one he went to first, but the Detroit and Chicago, you know, area, he moved there. But a lot of his followers stayed behind. And for a while, the Moors had in the Newark area, they had a presence. They had a temple on Court Street in Newark. And some people say in the very early days that Drew Ali, the founder of that group, lived Warren Street in Newark, which is in the downtown area where NJIT and Rutgers is. Yeah.
Why do you think Newark, New Jersey became kind of an attractive settlement place once you get the founding of the Nation of Islam? and Newark in particular, which I think it was a major station. If it wasn't one of the more popular places in the Northeast, it was one of the cities, I think, that had the highest population of Black migrants and during the height of the Black migration from the Great Migration out of the South. So what was it about Newark, do you think, that attracted so many of them to the city?
Yeah, it must have been jobs. I think it was, you know, some of the people that I interviewed, I remember describing Newark as an industrial city, and that there were, you know, opportunities here. And so, you know, it was a place, it wasn't as congested as New York, but it was, you know, they had opportunities here, and the population was less than what you had in New York. So I think people may have seen that as a, you know, as being attractive. You know, maybe I would try to settle there. And a lot of different groups were attracted to Newark at that time, you know, at the turn of the century, because of that. Because we had Germans. If you read some of Clement Price's work, he spoke about the Germans, because he did his dissertation, as I recall, on the history of the African-American community in Newark. You had Irish, you had Italians, you know, Slavs. So people, African-Americans coming from the South, they were also attracted. They heard about opportunities that were in Newark, where they could settle and try to start a new life. So among those African-Americans were people who had also claimed Islam. Drew Ali, the founder, as I said, there was another guy who was with him called Muhammad Ezzeldin. Some of my sources have led me to believe that he also came from the South. But yeah, all these people were in search of opportunities, and they thought that Newark was the place.
Yeah, I think you're right. Certainly proximity to New York, jobs, maybe even cheaper rent, places to live with the congestion in the city. New Jersey, we always, you know, our proximity to New York, we get overlooked many times. But Newark has one of the, it was a major destination site. And I think by 1940, the first destination site by the 1940s during the Great Migration. So tell us something about the key figures in this history. Where does Elijah Muhammad fit into all of this, for instance, as a key figure, or others that you either interviewed, written about?
So, you know, I met a guy when I was doing the master's thesis. I met this guy his name was Minheim. His name was James Minheim. And the way I met him was, a lot of the people that I was interviewing, they kept saying to me, you know, did you talk to Minheim? They kept bringing this guy's name up, you know, and it's like, you got to talk to Minheim. And it turns out that Minheim was a Moorish American. And his father was also a Moorish American. And when I met Minheim, he was 90 years old. He was elderly. But his father, Minheim told me that his father knew Noble Drew Ali. You know, which was interesting. And so that's why they were saying, you know, you got to talk to Minheim, you know. Yeah. And he gave me a picture. I've used it in some of my previous speeches, but he gave me a picture, has his father in the picture. It's a group picture. And his father is there, and there are some other members of the community that are there. And this picture was taken sometime during the first half of the 20th century, during that period. So another colorful fellow was this guy named Izzeldin, Muhammad Izzeldin. But before he became Muhammad Izzeldin, his name was, one of his names anyway, was Lomax Bey. And Bey was one of the surnames that the Moorish Americans used. Just like when people came into the Nation of Islam, they would drop their, what they call slave name, and they would adopt an X. You know, so Malcolm Little becomes Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Well, in the Moorish community, you didn't adopt an X, you adopted the name either Bey, B-E-Y, or Eel, E-L-L-L, you know. Hmm. Yeah, so this guy Lomax, they say that he was with Noble Drew Ali when he first came to Newark. And I haven't looked at this in so long, but I do think I have some documentation that substantiates that, you know, they were together. So Izzeldin, let me just say this, Izzeldin, before he, when he's Lomax Bey, he begins to, he eventually leaves the organization and he travels overseas. He goes to Egypt. I think this was in 1931. And he stays about 5 years, comes back in 1936. And that's when the name change happened. You know, it seemed like a lot of those guys were in search of what Islam was all about, you know, what they were learning in the Moor Science Temple apparently wasn't enough. They were looking to understand what Islam truly was. As you said, they were in contact with a lot of people from the Muslim world at certain stages of their life. And you know, this guy, he decides that he wants to travel to learn about the religion and learn about the history of his people. And he comes back in 1936 and he starts a Sunni Muslim organization. Now, he's not with the Moors anymore. Mm. And he starts a Sunni Muslim organization. This guy becomes the teacher of Hisham Jaber. Somehow they get connected. There was a guy that I interviewed named Abu Bakr. These are all African Americans now, you know. Wahab Abu Bakr, all of these people got involved in Sunni Islam, right? So what you have in Newark, okay, you have the Moorish Americans, you got these Sunni Muslims, African-American Sunni Muslims, and even the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he also came through Newark. And yeah, because there were temples set up that were established in Newark, I believe as early as the 1940s.
Okay.
And they were called the Allah Temples of Islam. So these were the people that were not a part of the Moors or part of the Black Sunnis, but they were following Elijah Muhammad. So all those three groups were crossing paths here in the Newark area.
Yeah, I think many people do not realize that, you know, when we think of Black Muslims, you know, there's Sunni, Shiite, there's, you know, the Black Nationalist Nation of Islam. There are multiple iterations over time and space. And even after Elijah Muhammad dies, there's yet another, you know, a splintering or iteration of groups that emerge. And Asbury Park plays a role in all of this, too. At one point, Asbury Park is referred to as Allah Town because you have so many Black Muslims. And I remember when I first came to Asbury Park, probably when I was, you know, small, a toddler with my dad, he used to take us down to the boardwalk. Whenever we would drive to the city, you would see the Fruits of Islam all up and down the street. Now, recently, I haven't seen them, their presence in quite some time. But interestingly enough, this summer, I saw at least one or two members of the Fruits of Islam, you know, with their papers and with their, I thought it was great to see them because, yeah, you know, the gentrification that's going on in that city. Yeah. And at one point had disappeared from the streets. So it was good to at least see that presence appear again in that space.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, the history is rich, Professor, you know, and, you know, I really think we need to do something. I'm so proud of your work because we really need to do something to preserve this heritage. The Black heritage is, you know, it's very broad and diverse. And the Muslims are a part of that.
Yes, definitely. And the links, the links between people of color globally, you know, what Black Studies is right now is, you know, this moment, this international turn. I don't feel enough has been done about, you know, written, you know, you got C. Eric Lincoln's monumental work and a lot of works on the history of the Nation of Islam out there. But looking at the international roots right here in New Jersey in the northeastern United States, looking at Boston, right, has a large Black Muslim community that includes all of these groups that you mentioned from, you know, around the globe, not just and the role of women. Right. Is it correct that some of Elijah Muhammad's relatives, his granddaughter, was it his great granddaughter? I think at once we had brought her to Mama a couple of years ago.
Right. Yeah. That was his granddaughter.
OK. Mm-hmm. So talk about the women and their role in, you know, the history of Islam and Islam among urban Blacks. What role do the women play? Or have played in the history?
Yeah, I mean, the women played a very significant role, a very important role. And I covered a little bit of it in the master's thesis that was turned into a book in 2008, but not nearly enough. You know, it didn't get as much coverage as it should have. But there have been a lot of women since then that have published a lot about the contribution that the Muslim women made to the community life. But as you know, I mean, the general idea was that the men would toil on the outside to build the nation, and you know, the women would do the work at home, if you will, you know. And the whole idea was to try to uplift our people, you know, to recapture our lost heritage and build community life, add to the African-American community, build ties with Muslims and other people in other parts of the world, and challenge America in what it was not doing right, and also, I guess, also complimented for what it was doing right. I think we see that in voices like Wallace, you know, Wallace Muhammad, who was the son of Elijah Muhammad. You know, I've been taking a lot of interest in some of the things he's been saying in recent years as well.
Yeah, so yeah, I remember Leila Muhammad. She came down just a couple of years ago to the Reese Conference. And one thing I noticed too, though, isn't there a history of Black women Muslims, the Black Muslim movement, as entrepreneurs?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, because if you look at, you know, obviously Khadija, right, she was a businesswoman.
She absolutely was. Yes, she was. In fact, the Prophet worked for her. You may know that Prophet Muhammad worked for her.
So that's something that I've noticed, that the women are very productive in being entrepreneurs and owning businesses,
very productive,
and all of that in Newark. That's one of the things I noticed in Newark and I spoke to Leila Muhammad briefly about this notion of having economic control, you know, that her grandfather really believed that this is tied, and that's connected to Booker T. Washington's idea. I mean, this notion that you have to have resources, material, money, and you have to own your own business and your own home. So, you know, in the sense, if you're going to build a strong Black nation, you must have entrepreneurs.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the women were very entrepreneurial. You know, and that's something that that legacy is still with us. You know, we are, you know, we have this idea, and the women are very significant in keeping that idea alive to do for self. You know, that we should become economically self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm. The self-help component. So what, as we close out our interview, talk to me a little bit about the Black Muslim presence in Boston. We know the story of Malcolm X coming to live with his sister, Ella, in the city of Boston, really spent his formative years there after his mother was institutionalized. Boston has a very strong presence of Black Muslims down to today. What parallels or connections or information you might share with us about Black Muslims in the Boston region?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like, unfortunately, I don't have too much to share, you know, I mean, because my focus has been mostly on New Jersey, mm-hmm. but I do know that Malcolm spent a considerable amount of time in there. I think even Minister Farrakhan was a minister in Boston. So I know the influence in that city, you know, the Islamic influence is strong there. Malcolm spent time there from his teenage years up to the time he was incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he was living with his sister.
Yes.
At the time, he was living with Ella Collins. And, you know, I don't know, I can't recall anyway, a lot of details about the Boston area as I can about Jersey. You know?
But I would think I think some of the things that you've said about building businesses and getting involved in activism, the Collins family has been very involved in activism. It's just a history of Ella was an activist, just mm-hmm. like her brother. And I think she gets overlooked because she really is the one who sort of nurtured him and I think played a definite role in him converting to Islam in the city of Boston. So that's something we hope to help preserve in this city, and
right.
More information about the connections. I'm very interested in the connections between these cities of the Northeast and then the Black freedom struggle more, you know, more broadly. But Professor Nash, thank you so much for spending some time with me today on Black in Boston and beyond.
Thank you very much, Professor. I'm so glad we had an opportunity to start, I guess I should say continue this conversation, because we've been talking about this for a while now.
Yes, we definitely will continue the conversation.